Welcome back to the Deep Dive. This is the place where we cut through all the noise of the financial world. We take the stacks of insight, the data, all that analysis, and we distill it down for you.
Right. We get to the critical knowledge you need to be, you know, truly well-informed.
I'm Chris Vanderbilt, and I'm, as always, thrilled to be joined by my guide through all this complexity, Alex Astor.
It is great to be back. And our mission today is, I'd say it's probably the most forward-looking one we've had all year.
We're not just looking at the current quarter.
Not at all. We're setting the stage for 2026. We're going to be exploring some really seismic shifts that are going to redefine entire sectors, everything from corporate power structures to your own personal consumption habits.
We're going to give you that complete holistic view of the forces that are all converging on the market.
Exactly.
And we're focusing on one comprehensive source today. It's a deep exploration of the financial and economic landscape right as the year winds down. And it gives us a critical roadmap for the year ahead.
So the title for this deep dive is Barron's Magazine for the week of December 22nd, 2025.
We have so much ground to cover. Let's start at the very top of the corporate food chain, because we are seeing just monumental change across three American icons.
That's right where the sources begin. It focuses on this changing of the guard. We're witnessing these incredibly consequential leadership transitions at Walmart, at Berkshire Hathaway, and at Apple.
And all at the same time.
All converging as we head into 2026. I mean, these are companies that, you know, they collectively represent the highest standards of American efficiency, capital allocation, market disruption.
And having these handovers happen concurrently, It's a huge deal.
It really marks an unmistakable kind of momentous reset in the American corporate psyche.
Okay, so let's unpack this. I want to focus on the succession planning because the approach each company takes is fascinating. It really reflects their core culture.
It absolutely does.
Start with Walmart, the largest private employer in the world. Their transition is happening on a pre-programmed date. They've got it down to the day.
That extreme precision really speaks to their operational DNA, doesn't it? Doug McMillon, he's the outgoing CEO. He's held the post since February of 2014.
Right.
He is officially handing the reins over to John Furner. Furner is the current president and CEO of Walmart U.S.
And that happens February 1st, 2026.
And Wall Street's reaction has been, well, pretty much a shrug of confidence. And in this context, that is a massive positive signal.
A shrug is a good thing here.
It's a great thing. For a company that relies so heavily on frictionless operations and, you know, supply chain dominance, succession is truly, as the source says, mission critical.
So what gives Wall Street that confidence? What's the foundation for it?
It's continuity and deep, deep institutional knowledge. John Furner has 33 years of tenure at Walmart.
33 years. Wow.
He's not an outsider brought in to shake things up. He is, you know, the embodiment of the company's internal stability. The perception is that this transition will be smooth.
Because the next leader has been vetted across decades.
Decades of service. Exactly. It ensures the core values, the processes that generate Walmart's phenomenal scale. All of that remains undisturbed.
That deep internal focus is clearly a strategic choice. And while we're talking about Walmart and its massive scale, the sources included a detail that really highlights how this established retail giant sees itself against the new wave of tech giants.
You mean Apple?
Specifically Apple.
It's a fantastic anecdote. It really demonstrates their autonomy. Walmart is famously one of the few national retailers that has just adamantly refused to accept Apple Pay.
And they do that for a reason.
A very strategic reason. They promote Walmart Pay instead. And this isn't just about a payment system. It's a very strong signal. It signals that they intend to control their own customer data, their own transaction ecosystem. They want total autonomy from the tech platforms that are, you know, trying to integrate themselves into every single piece of consumer life.
So they're drawing a line in the sand.
A very clear boundary. They're saying, we own the relationship with the consumer, not Silicon Valley.
An essential battleground in the age of big data.
Okay, let's pivot. Let's go to a completely different type of transition. The almost philosophical handover at Berkshire Hathaway.
Right. Warren Buffett, who has been running the company since 1965, a tenure the source rightly describes as slightly shorter than forever.
Right.
He is finally passing the major responsibility to Greg Abel on New Year's Day.
This handover is layered with a unique kind of anxiety, though.
It really is. And it's not anxiety that the company's going to fail. I mean, Berkshire Hathaway is a fortress of diversified assets. The anxiety stems from the question of whether anyone can replicate Buffett's his genius.
That qualitative genius and capital allocation? That's it. Abel is the vice chairman of non-insurance operations. He brings 27 years of deep knowledge. But the sources focus on Buffett's philosophy behind the choice. He said the CEO selection is the most important decision that you make.
And what specifically was he looking for beyond just, you know, raw competency?
He valued devotion. Devotion to Berkshire's culture and its long-term values over just being the most brilliant manager in a specific field. He famously said he chose Abel because he wanted someone devoted to the company for life.
Not just someone with a high IQ.
Exactly. Not just someone who was, you know, high on IQ. This just underscores that culture of permanent ownership and ethical stewardship that Buffett built.
So Abel's challenge isn't just running the businesses.
No, it's maintaining that intangible reputation, the one that allows Berkshire to execute these unique, large-scale deals based purely on trust. It's the ultimate test of cultural succession.
And speaking of Berkshire, we can't ignore the massive irony here in Buffett's investment history, the dynamic between all three of these corporate icons.
Ooh, that tension is striking. On one hand, you have Berkshire's $35 billion investment in Apple.
Which is his single best stock investment ever, in dollar terms.
Ever. It generated a staggering $100 billion in pre-tax profits. It's a huge driver of Berkshire's current value. But
on the other hand,
the sources remind us that he started selling his stake in Walmart way back in 2015.
During the early days of McMillan's tenure. So he essentially mistimed Walmart's incredible growth phase.
Completely. He missed the subsequent explosive growth that McMillan presided over. And the irony is that the man famous for being the most patient long-term investor in history,
the one who generated immense wealth from Apple,
missed a significant leg up on a traditional massive retailer like Walmart, a stock he had previously criticized himself for not buying sooner.
It's a fantastic reminder, isn't it, that even the financial oracles are capable of human error?
Absolutely. But more importantly, it shows the difficulty in holding on to businesses for truly generations, even when they start to look a little boring.
A vital lesson for the average investor. Timing is often the difference between a great return and an astronomical one. Now, let's turn to Apple. The transition there is signaled, but it's not complete yet.
No, Tim Cook is still at the helm. He just turned 65, and the expectation is he stays for at least two more years.
And that two-year window is critical.
It is. It's tied directly to the need for him to fully implement Apple's massive artificial intelligence strategy.
Right. They've been seen as lagging the hype curve in AI compared to their peers.
For a long time. So Cook needs to ensure that strategy is deeply embedded and producing results before he steps away.
But the sources also point to clear signals that the winding down of the Cook era is already underway. It's signaled not by his departure, but by the departure of those around him.
Precisely. We're seeing this controlled, multi-year switch out of executives who are in their 60s.
For 60-plus crowd.
The announced departures of key deputies, Chief Operating Officer Jeff Williams, General Counsel Kate Adams, Head of Government Affairs Lisa Jackson. These are not signs of a crisis.
They're signs of a carefully managed transition.
Exactly. An insider used the brilliant phrase that this process is about maintaining the magic. It's about ensuring that institutional knowledge transfers seamlessly before the top job is handed over.
So who is the internal favorite to inherit the mantle of the world's most valuable company?
Well, the current betting pool favors John Ternus. He's 50, currently the senior vice president of hardware engineering. He's a veteran, 25 years at Apple.
And the consistency across all three of these iconic transitions is remarkable.
It really is. Ternus, 25 years. Abel, 27 years. Ferner, 33 years. This commitment to deep internal institutional knowledge taking the reins is the defining characteristic of this corporate era.
So the investor takeaway is clear.
For stability and compounding returns, trust the process of internal growth and continuity.
That internal continuity seems to be the single biggest metric for stability and future success. So let's quantify the staggering impact of this previous era. When you look at the aggregate value created by these three leaders, the numbers are just, they're almost fictional.
They are enormous. The three CEOs collectively generated $5.5 trillion of value for shareholders.
$5.5 trillion.
But the bulk of that, the single greatest value creation engine in corporate history, was Tim Cook's tenure at Apple.
Okay, lay out the numbers.
When he took over in August 2011, Apple's market cap was $350 billion. Today, it stands at $4.1 trillion.
That is a $3.75 trillion increase in value.
Just just incredible. For context, Buffett's Berkshire is worth $1.1 trillion, and Macmillan grew Walmart from $242 billion to $920 billion, almost four times bigger.
That is just incomprehensible growth. But the sources use these figures to deliver a powerful lesson about the cost of fear and short-sightedness for the average investor.
It's a very stark reminder. The source provides a hypothetical. Imagine you had a $100,000 stake in Apple when Tim Cook took over. If you sold it then, you were fearful of the change, and you put that $100,000 into a simple S&P 500 index fund instead. Your S&P investment today would be worth $570,850.
Which is a great return, over $500,000. Very respectable.
Great return, right.
Yeah.
But your Apple stock, had you simply held on, would be worth $2,040,270 today.
Wow.
That is an opportunity loss of nearly $1.5 million. The quote the sources are driving toward is that when it comes to these American icons, these companies built on generational stability, it pays to trust the long-term process.
Trust the management, the institutional continuity, over those short-term fears about leadership changes.
Trust the process.
Trust the process. That's a powerful lesson heading into a new year. And it's a great segue to our next topic, which involves market growth so massive it is literally changing the American body politic. The GLP-1 megatrend.
Oh, yes.
These weight loss drugs are already huge, but 2026 is projected to be the year they reach true ubiquity.
That's absolutely correct. The sources identify 2026 as a major inflection point. It's going to drive market penetration far beyond what current investors are even expecting.
And this explosion is powered by two forces.
Two parallel and equally potent forces. The long-awaited arrival of oral pills, and perhaps more importantly, a massive expansion of health insurance coverage, particularly through government programs.
Okay, before we get into the convenience factor of the pills,
yeah,
for listeners who might have only heard the names Ozempic or Wegovy,
yeah,
let's briefly define what GLP-1 drugs actually do, physiologically.
That's important context. So GLP-1 stands for glucagon-like peptide 1. These drugs mimic a natural hormone in your body.
Okay.
And when you take them, they do three main things. First, they increase insulin secretion, which helps regulate blood sugar. That's why they were originally for type 2 diabetes.
Right.
Second, and this is crucial for weight loss, they slow gastric emptying. Food stays in your stomach longer. You feel full faster. They act directly on the brain's satiety centers. They reduce hunger and cravings. That combination is what makes them so incredibly effective.
So we have the injectables like Zepbound and Wegovy dominating right now. But the market is about to be reshaped by the pill format. It eliminates that barrier of the needle.
The pill format is the next frontier. Novo Nordisk is expected to get regulatory approval for oral semaglutide.
That's the same active ingredient as Ozempic and Wegovy.
The very same. They expect approval by late 2025, so sales in early 2026. And right behind them is Eli Lilly with its competitor, orforglipron.
And that's expected to be approved in Q1 2026 and launching Q2.
The race for the oral market is on.
Lilly currently leads the injectable market in terms of efficacy, right?
Yeah.
Their drugs have shown 20% plus weight loss in trials. That's what helped push the company to that recent $1 trillion market value.
It is a huge part of it.
Does that efficacy advantage carry over to the pill format?
Not entirely, which is an interesting wrinkle. When you look at the trial data, the pills are competitive with each other, but they are slightly behind the injectable leaders.
How far behind?
Well, Novo Nordisk's oral semaglutide resulted in about a 16.6% weight loss over 64 weeks. Lilly's orforglipron showed a 12.4% loss over 72 weeks.
Those are still life-changing numbers for patients.
Absolutely. But they are slightly below the top-tier injectables.
So if the pills are slightly less efficacious, why is Wall Street, and specifically analysts like Morgan Stanley, so incredibly bullish on their future market dominance?
Because convenience outweighs that minor loss of efficacy for mass market penetration. The pill format addresses two huge psychological and logistical barriers.
The needle phobia.
First, the needle phobic population, and second, the issue of patient compliance. As one fund manager put it, if you're already taking a daily pill for cholesterol or blood pressure, you just throw in another pill. It's not a big deal.
As opposed to a weekly injection, which is a conscious, active medical procedure.
Exactly, and there are significant financial and logistical advantages to the pills, too.
Cheaper to make.
significantly cheaper and easier to manufacture at scale than these sterile injectable pens. And crucially, they don't require refrigeration.
Which leads to a wild projection from Morgan Stanley.
It does. They forecast that Lilly's easier, cheaper, or Forglipron sales will actually overtake the sales of its own superior injectable Zepbound by 2030.
Wow.
And that will be driven primarily by massive uptake in markets outside the U.S. where refrigeration and logistics are much bigger barriers.
That is a fascinating dynamic. The easier, cheaper access point ultimately generating more revenue, even if the injectable provides a few more percentage points of weight loss. Mm. But the true game changer, the policy shift, that's what will drive U.S. volume.
Now, this is a monumental regulatory pivot. It's focused on Medicare and Medicaid.
What's the deal?
Under a November deal reached with the Trump administration, Lilly and Novo Nordisk agreed to deep cuts in the cost of their obesity drugs for government plans.
And in exchange.
In exchange, these plans will expand coverage to include obesity treatment, not just conditions like diabetes or heart disease, and cap the patient copay at a maximum of $50 a month.
$50 a month.
Starting in April.
A $50 maximum copay fundamentally changes the calculus for millions of Americans who previously couldn't afford the $1,000-plus list price. What does this do to the addressable market size?
It creates a vertical market explosion. This policy shift immediately opens the door to 20 to 25 million obese Medicare patients.
That's a massive new population pool.
And we haven't even factored in the millions more with type 2 diabetes who will now have greatly reduced copays. When you consider that fewer than 10 million people total currently use GLP-1 drugs.
You're talking about the potential to triple the treated population in the U.S.
In a very short time frame, yes.
This expansion, coupled with lower cash prices for the pills, should also address a serious public health hazard that has grown alongside the high cost of these medications, the counterfeit market.
It absolutely should. The high list price created this dangerous vacuum that was filled by drug compounders selling knockoff GLP-1s.
The sources estimate over a million patients are currently using these.
Potentially unsafe, unregulated counterfeit versions. By providing cheaper, legitimate pills and reducing the financial barrier for insured patients, the market will naturally draw these patients away from that dangerous supply chain.
So lowering the financial barrier is the most effective form of patient safety intervention?
Without a doubt.
Okay, so given this massive tailwind, Morgan Stanley is projecting $100 billion in sales for Lilly alone by 2030. That's an enormous figure. What makes them so far ahead of the $78 billion consensus estimate?
They're using historical analogs, specifically the introduction of statin drugs in the 80s and 90s.
The cholesterol drugs.
Right. Statins went from these niche cardiology drugs to household names. They achieved very high penetration rates. Morgan Stanley believes the impact of GLP-1s will be similar.
So they're projecting up to 30% U.S. market penetration.
Which is about 30 million patients. Triple the current number. Their $100 billion forecast combines sales from Lilly's entire portfolio, Mounjaro, Zepbound, the new oral or Forglipron, and their next-gen drugs.
Lilly's stock has already tripled since 2022. It trades at a lofty 44 times projected 2025 earnings. Given that high valuation, is it possible the market has already priced in this mega penetration?
That's the critical question for you as an investor. If you look at that 44 PE, it looks expensive, no question. However, if Morgan Stanley's higher $100 billion sales estimate is anywhere near accurate, the stock may actually be cheaper than it looks based on future earnings growth.
How much cheaper?
Analysts estimate that if these projections materialize, the next doubling of Lilly's earnings could occur in as little as 3 years.
Which implies the market is still struggling to fully grasp the sheer scale of the shift we're discussing.
I think that's exactly right.
And the research doesn't stop there. What about the next generation of these weight loss drugs?
They're targeting the major drawbacks of the current generation. Right now, a significant concern with GLP-1s is the loss of lean muscle mass along with the fat.
Right. You want to lose fat, not muscle.
So Lilly is developing retatrutide, which uses three mechanisms of action instead of one or two. It could offer greater efficacy and better metabolic profiles. They're also working on eloralintide, which works on a completely different hormone system, specifically to minimize that lean muscle mass loss.
The innovation runway here is just exceptionally long.
It is.
The health implications are revolutionary, but the ripple effects on consumer spending and the food industry. That's a huge economic story playing out in real time.
They certainly are. We're observing the slowest sales growth for food companies in years. And while stress on lower-income shoppers and brand competition are factors,
GLP-1s are under serious suspicion.
Even if companies aren't explicitly blaming them yet, but the hard data from grocery stores tells a clear story.
What's the data?
Sales growth around the store perimeters, where you find fresh produce, meat, dairy, is running 2 to 3 points ahead of the center aisles.
Where all these shelf-stable, high-calorie packaged goods and snacks live?
Precisely. Consumers on these drugs are making structural changes to their consumption.
And the demographics of the next wave of users will only intensify this pressure on comfort and processed foods.
This is the critical socioeconomic point. To date, GLP-1 usage has skewed heavily toward higher-income households because of the cost barrier.
Right.
The next wave, driven by that Medicare and Medicaid policy shift, will skew toward middle- and low-income households.
And why does that matter so much?
Because this demographic tends to have higher eating occasions, higher calorie density in their food choices, and higher elasticity regarding spending on things like snacks and fast food.
So when this population adopts GLP-1s,
the impact on their consumption habits, their total calorie intake, and their spending on restaurants and packaged goods will be significantly more noticeable than the initial wave.
So even if the economy stabilizes, the consumption habits of the country are being fundamentally altered. It's capping the recovery for many food and restaurant businesses.
That's the core conclusion. It's great news for public health, but tough times are likely ahead for the cookie aisle, the soda section, and many fast casual restaurants reliant on those high-density calorie purchases.
The market isn't just expanding.
It is structurally shifting consumer behavior forever.
A tough time for packaged foods, indeed. Yeah. That level of technological disruption is massive. And speaking of industries being revolutionized by technology, let's look at how the same high-powered AI chips driving Lilly's drug discovery are now causing a deep geopolitical crisis.
A crisis regarding trade and regulation, yes. This story about Tencent Holdings reveals a profound regulatory gap in U.S. export controls.
This is arguably the most critical geopolitical flashpoint in the sources. The U.S. government has implemented clear export restrictions.
Right. Designed to prevent Chinese companies from owning the most advanced U.S. chips, specifically the cutting-edge NVIDIA Blackwell GPUs.
The concern is that these chips could be used to advance Chinese military and surveillance AI capabilities.
But China's largest company by market value, Tencent Holdings, is finding a clear path around those restrictions.
How exactly are they managing to access this restricted computing power without technically violating U.S. law?
They're exploiting a critical loophole. It's all about remote access and third-party allies. Tencent is partnering with a Tokyo-based company, Data Section.
They're a cloud data center operator in Japan and Australia.
Right. And Data Section secured deals for 15,000 Blackwell GPUs. So by setting up a client relationship where they access the computing power remotely through a third-party cloud service in an allied country,
they avoid violating the U.S. rules that prevent them from owning the physical restricted hardware themselves.
Exactly.
So the physical chips remain in an allied country, but the computational power, the entire point of the restriction, is effectively being funneled to China. This feels like a blatant undermining of the policy's intent.
It is. And the political implications are immediate. This arrangement actively undermines President Trump's recent public assurance that the Blackwell line and the upcoming Rubin line would remain strictly off limits to China.
Even while allowing the less powerful H200 chip.
Right. The policy was clear. America first, technology protection. But this remote access setup provides a clear, permissible bypass.
And lawmakers are not quiet about this.
Not at all. Congressional concern is high. New York Representative Mike Lawler characterized the practice as a dangerous loophole.
And he stressed the obvious point that export controls are only as strong as the weakest link in the chain.
And China is actively exploiting relationships with U.S. allies to get the power they need. The complexity of these cloud structures makes enforcement a nightmare.
What is NVIDIA's official stance on this? What's their defense for allowing this kind of arrangement?
NVIDIA's defense is nuanced. They argue that they are playing within the letter of the law. They claim the rules specifically permit approved firms in allied countries like Japan and Australia to build and operate these large AI clouds.
So their position is that this strategy maintains American technology leadership.
And economic security. Because NVIDIA still sells the hardware, making the United States the technological winner, even if Chinese firms are the remote clients.
It sounds like a sophisticated tightrope walk between adhering to sanctions and maintaining massive revenue streams from that insatiable Chinese demand for AI infrastructure.
That's a good way to put it.
But the sources also highlight some highly unusual activities surrounding the Japanese cloud provider data section.
Right, suggesting major corporate scrutiny. That scrutiny is deep, and it raises serious questions about the nature of this deal. Wolfpack Research, for example, took a short position on data section's stock.
Why?
Specifically because they expect regulators to step in and interfere, arguing the cloud deals are fundamentally too risky. Data section's stock took a nearly 14% hit after the report.
Though it has since recovered.
It has. And while data section's CEO insists the deals were legally vetted by U.S. counsel, the corporate governance details are suspect.
Tell us about those red flags.
The sourcing details point to several issues. First, data section underwent an extremely unusual auditor change.
Okay.
At the very same board meeting where the CEO was named, they changed their auditor from the Japanese affiliate of PwC, a major global firm, to a much, much smaller Tokyo-based firm called Amaterasu.
Which only audits a handful of public companies.
Right. Data section claimed this was for expertise and independence, but the optics are poor, especially when undertaking a massive, sensitive deal like this.
That is a significant red flag in high-stakes finance. What about the partner involved in the projects?
That detail's even more bizarre. Data section is partnering with a firm called Naonao Japan for the large Osaka and Sydney data center projects.
And data section claimed this partner had a large number of engineers.
But public data from the Japan Pension Service, which tracks mandatory social insurance enrollment, shows the firm had only 4 employees enrolled. 4. This vast discrepancy raises fundamental questions about who is truly doing the work, who is vetting the security of these data centers, and the legitimacy of the whole partnership structure.
This chain of events, the auditor change, the tiny partner firm, the legal maneuvering, it suggests a deeply calculated attempt to operate on the very edge of legality. And the funding mechanism seems to confirm the perceived risk.
It absolutely does. Data section could not secure funding for these massive cloud infrastructure projects from mainstream Japanese banks.
Why not?
Because those banks were deeply concerned about the regulatory and reputational risk related to Tencent's ultimate involvement.
So instead, the funding was secured by selling purchase options, or warrants, to a Singapore-based entity.
A company called First Plus Financial. So yes, traditional regulated finance was too nervous to touch the deal, forcing them to find funding through a less conventional warrant-based mechanism.
This whole story just illustrates that in the race for AI dominance, companies are willing to test the regulatory boundaries to the absolute breaking point.
Using the weakest link in allied systems to gain access to world-changing computing power.
And the success of this circumvention strategy just underscores the difficulty policymakers face. Technology moves at the speed of light.
And regulation moves at the speed of government?
That rapid technological advancement leads us right into our next section, where we look at how technology is blurring the lines in finance and market strategy. It touches on everything from political outcomes to the price of an egg.
Let's start with a really uncomfortable question that the sources highlight, one being debated by regulators globally. The line between investing and gambling.
Right. The rise of prediction markets is forcing this issue.
It's a massive ethical and regulatory gray area. These prediction markets allow users to wager on future outcomes, like who will win an election, whether a policy will pass, if a merger will close.
And the fact that commission-free trading platforms like Robinhood are showing significant interest in this sector means these markets are moving from niche status directly into the mainstream.
The core debate is whether these markets provide useful, aggregated information for investors, a legitimate financial tool, or if they are simply sophisticated betting platforms dressed up in financial terminology.
And if they're the latter?
They pose critical issues for consumer protection, financial stability, and how they should be regulated. The industry wants them treated like futures or options. Regulators worry they are simply pure wagers on future events.
Which should be treated like gambling and restricted.
Exactly.
It seems like the technological ease of market making is outpacing the regulatory definitions of finance. And while some people are betting on the future price of a stock, AI is actively determining the current price of everyday goods.
Creating an intensely personalized system. This is the rise of hyper-personalized pricing. We are far past simple dynamic pricing where a hotel room costs more on a Saturday.
This is different.
Now, AI uses massive individualized data sets, your device type, your browsing history, whether you search for the item twice, your location, your perceived urgency, to determine the highest price you are individually willing to pay.
So if the algorithm determines I need an item urgently, or if I'm browsing on an expensive high-end device, I might be quoted a higher price than someone else looking at the exact same product at the exact same time.
Exactly. The mechanism is designed to maximize the seller's revenue by exploiting your specific willingness to pay. If the AI identifies you as a high-value, price-insensitive shopper, it quotes you a premium.
And if it identifies you as highly price-sensitive?
It might quote you a lower price, ensuring they still capture your business. This is why you might see two different prices for the same product in the same physical store if you're using an app.
And naturally, this generates a strong pushback. It feels inherently unfair to pay more simply because the algorithm has successfully profiled you.
The pushback is immediate and growing. The sources confirm that some lawmakers are now actively pushing for legislation and new regulations against this increasingly opaque and personalized pricing model.
Because the lack of transparency is the main target.
Right. Consumers feel targeted and often helpless against an algorithm that knows more about their purchasing history and urgency than they even realize.
Okay, shifting to the pure market outlook for 2026. We have a few rapid-fire, high-conviction takes from various source columns. First, a stark warning for the tech infrastructure supply chain.
The TechTrader column is sounding an alarm bell. It's using Micron technology as the canary in a coal mine. The advice is clear. Investors should brace for another chip shortage.
So that massive, sustained, and growing demand for AI infrastructure is still running hot.
It's draining the supply chain for memory, advanced packaging, and other key components. The scarcity issue is far from over.
On the other side of the risk spectrum, the fixed income market offers a refreshing perspective.
Yes, the income section is decidedly placid. It confidently states that bonds will be just fine in 2026.
Which is a significant point of confidence.
It is. Despite lingering inflation surprises and anticipated economic slowdowns, there's a fundamental belief that the bond market will provide stability and adequate returns. It's reinforcing its role as a necessary anchor in a volatile portfolio.
What's the general advice for the equity investor going into a year marked by such volatility and regulatory pressure?
The trader column recommends a strategic shift, focusing on the longer term for better sleep in 2026. It's an acknowledgement that the market will continue to react, overreact, and recover in the short term.
The volatility is now a permanent feature.
It is. Fighting that short-term noise is costly and futile. Patient, long-term strategy is the required antidote.
And finally, a word of caution from the striking price columnist who is urging caution ahead of the calendar flipping.
The advice is almost biblical. Avoid big investing decisions ahead of 2026 and don't be the fool rushing in.
So given the complexity, corporate upheaval, drug market restructuring, chip wars, the wisest course might be to wait.
Wait for the first few months of the new year, let the dust settle, and gain greater clarity on policy and market direction.
That seems like exceptionally sound advice. Now let's turn from caution to conviction. We are going to dig into where the professional money managers, the ones who actually beat the market in 2025, are putting their capital for 2026.
This is critical context because active management is exceptionally difficult right now. The S&P 500 was up 16% in the first half of 2025.
Driven largely by the massive tech winners.
Right. And only 31% of active U.S. stock funds managed to beat a comparable index fund through June. The three funds we're focusing on delivered impressive, differentiated results.
Proving there are still major opportunities outside the largest mega-cap tech stocks.
Absolutely.
Let's start with Tanaka Growth. Sounds like a concentrated, highly selective fund.
It is. Tanaka Growth, ticker TGFRX, has been a stellar performer. It returned nearly 50% this year and beat 99% of its rivals over the last 5 years.
A 22.4% annualized return.
The manager, Graham Tanaka, who has an engineering background and an MBA, runs a tightly focused portfolio, just 24 stocks.
And he deliberately concentrates on small and mid-caps.
With an average market cap of only $32 billion, his thesis is built on deep research and finding companies with management-driven, proprietary, competitive edges.
What is his highest conviction pick? The one that truly defines his strategy.
His largest position, representing a massive 15% of the portfolio, is Corcept Therapeutics. They're currently known for treating Cushing's syndrome, a rare hormonal disorder.
But the investment thesis is entirely focused on their future.
Specifically, leveraging their deep expertise in cortisol and steroid chemistry to expand into much larger areas, cancer and ALS.
So he's betting on a pipeline pivot based on specialized knowledge. What is the evidence for this high-stakes bet?
They reported positive phase 3 trial results for relacorilant, a new drug for ovarian cancer, back in March. They expect to file for FDA and European regulatory reviews in 2026.
That's the crucial catalyst.
It is. And Tanaka is willing to accept a current price-earnings ratio of 81 times estimated 2025 profits.
Wait, 81 times earnings? That screams overvalued by traditional metrics. How does he justify that?
He justifies it by dismissing the short-term number entirely. He's essentially pricing in the next decade of success. He views the high PE as an artifact of a company whose earnings are currently depressed but are about to explode.
So he projects that if the regulatory approvals are secured in 2026.
The stock, currently trading around $82, has a clear path to jump to $180 by 2027. He is betting that the current price is actually cheap for a company that he projects has 10 years of blockbuster growth ahead of them.
That's a pure growth bet rooted in deep scientific conviction. What is his second pick, United States Antimony? This sounds like a completely different play.
A strategic materials bet. It is a perfect example of his niche-focused strategy. United States Antimony is the only U.S. producer of antimony products.
And antimony is a critical mineral used in specialized batteries, solar panels, and crucially, military ordnance.
And this company directly benefited from geopolitical friction. China, which dominates the global antimony market, began restricting exports last year,
making domestic supply immediately strategically important.
And the U.S. government stepped in to shore up its domestic supply chain.
So this helped U.S. antimony secure a massive five-year, $245 million deal with the Pentagon.
Alongside a substantial $107 million commercial contract, this shift in strategic importance is fueling phenomenal revenue growth, which is expected to triple to $125 million in 2026.
That is a fascinating example of how geopolitics can generate unique investment opportunities. Let's move to the second winner, Alger Focus Equity. Clearly has a high-growth, high-tech profile.
Alger Focus Equity, ALGRX, is run by Patrick Kelly and Ankur Crawford. It's a consistently high performer, returning 40% this year and 20% annualized over the last decade.
They're highly concentrated 49 stocks, with more than two-thirds of their assets in technology and communications.
Their philosophy is simple. Identify companies that are aggressively innovating and benefiting from technological change, and avoid business models that are being disrupted.
We know they hold the mega caps like Microsoft and NVIDIA, but what are their unique high-growth winners?
The sources highlight Applovin. They place ads in mobile games, and the stock nearly doubled in 2025. Kelly believes Wall Street is still significantly underestimating its earnings growth potential,
largely due to its AI advantage.
Right. Applovin uses proprietary artificial intelligence to target video game ads with superior efficiency. And this same AI helps them lower ad costs for merchants, making the platform exceptionally attractive.
And what are the catalysts for Trend 26 beyond just better ad targeting?
Two major new market avenues. First, they launched a significant e-commerce push in October, integrating shopping directly into the gaming experience.
And second,
they're expanding aggressively abroad. Despite the stock's huge run-up, Kelly is still buying, willing to pay 45 times estimated 2026 earnings.
That 45 times PE is certainly steep. What about Western Digital, ticker WDC? This company has historically been incredible cyclical, tying to the boom and bust cycle of PC components.
Western Digital is another sizzling pick for Alger, up a remarkable 255% in 2025.
Driven by the massive data storage needs created by the AI boom.
Exactly. Yet despite that massive run, the stock is still trading at what look like cheap multiples 21 times 2026 estimated earnings. This is due to profound market skepticism. Investors are worried that WDC has not truly shed its cyclical history.
So what is Alger's thesis to overcome that skepticism?
Kelly argues that the new massive multi-year contracts the company has secured with large cloud providers, the very entities building the AI data centers, provide a stability layer that Western Digital has never had before.
So these long-term contracts secure revenue and demand for years to come,
fundamentally decoupling the stock from the volatile PC component cycle. It's a bet that the AI structural shift has permanently stabilized a historically unstable business.
And the third pick from Alger, QXO, is a different kind of growth story, a management-driven roll-up strategy.
QXO is a fascinating play. It's run by billionaire Brad Jacobs, who is famous for buying up and integrating companies in fragmented sectors. QXO is a building supply distributor play.
And his strategy is aggressive.
He aims to double the company's annual operating profit to $2 billion over the next 5 years, with a long-term goal of hitting $50 billion in revenue by 2035.
They kick this off by acquiring Beacon Roofing Supply for $11 billion in April.
It's a pure belief in the management team's ability to execute a complex integration and acquisition strategy in the industrial sector.
Finally, let's look at Fidelity Large Cap Stock, FLCSX. They seem to be taking a much more restrained approach, deliberately avoiding the massive tech frenzy.
That's the defining characteristic of portfolio manager Matthew Fruhan. While he had a strong year, beating 97% of his rivals, he is cautious on the tech sector.
He's allocating only 26% of his portfolio there.
His emphasis is on relatively cheaper industrials and financials. He runs a low turnover fund, holding many top stocks since 2022, suggesting he favors deep value, long-term turnaround plays.
Tell us about his two major picks, starting with the industrial play, Boeing.
Boeing has been in the news for years due to quality control issues and the 737 MAX crashes, which have severely depressed its earnings.
In the short term, the stock looks incredibly expensive. It's trading at 99 times 2026 expected earnings.
But Fruhan sees this as a cyclical opportunity. He argues you have to look past the depressed earnings.
So what does the recovery path look like?
The crucial catalyst was regulatory. The FAA cleared Boeing in October to produce 42 737 MAX planes a month, up from the restricted 38.
So assuming production ramps up successfully and the quality issues are resolved.
Which is a big assumption, granted. But if so, the stock trades at a much more reasonable 25 times expected 2028 earnings. Fruhan is applying a long-term cyclical lens here.
And what about his financial pick, Wells Fargo? That is a definitive turnaround story after years of scandal.
It is. Fruhan gives high marks to CEO Charles Scharf, who took the helm in 2019. Scharf has worked painstakingly to change the guts of the company and address the massive cultural and legal issues post-scandal.
And the key milestone was the Federal Reserve lifting its long-standing growth restrictions on the bank in June.
That action signals immense regulatory confidence that the bank has fixed its internal controls. Fruhan expects Wells Fargo's profit profile to rapidly catch up to megabank leaders like JPMorgan Chase.
And he sees technology playing a role in reinforcing the dominance of the biggest financial players.
Absolutely. This goes back to our earlier point about AI infrastructure. Megabanks like Wells Fargo, JPMorgan, and Bank of America are pouring tens of billions of dollars into AI development, technology upgrades, and advanced fraud detection systems.
And these massive investments create a competitive moat that smaller regional rivals just can't afford to match.
Right. Fruhan believes this investment gap will ultimately lead to a dynamic where the large are going to get larger in the financial sector, accelerating consolidation and market share gains for the titans.
That gives us a fantastic summary of where the smartest active money is placing its bets. Let's shift gears and focus on tectonic shifts in retail and consumer finance, starting with the off-price segment.
Off-price retail-like stores where you hunt for bargains is inherently resilient, especially when consumer budgets are strained. But Burlington Stores has dramatically lagged its peers.
Its stock has gained less than 10% in 5 years.
Compared to 130% for TJX and 55% for Ross Stores.
Why the massive underperformance, and why are the sources now suggesting it's too cheap to ignore?
Burlington historically suffered from self-inflicted wounds related to poor store footprint strategy and inefficient merchandising. Its internal operations were just not as tight as its rivals.
But management has been executing a determined and successful turnaround plan.
They're aggressively optimizing the store footprint, closing larger underperforming locations, and replacing them with smaller, more profitable stores. They're also modernizing their distribution centers and, critically, improving merchandising consistency.
Has that turnaround translated into financial results that justify the bullishness?
Yes. Burlington has delivered strong EPS growth of over 30% in the last 2 years, validating their efforts with value-conscious shoppers.
And consensus estimates project almost 20% EPS growth for the current fiscal year.
And here's the key. It trades cheapest among its peers at 24 times fiscal 2027 estimates, and their gross margins are expanding rapidly.
Currently at nearly 40%. With analysts expecting them to push past 43% in 2 years.
Potentially outpacing both TJX and Ross's historical margins.
And there are specific legislative tailwinds that could provide an immediate boost to Burlington's specific customer base, which skews lower income.
That's a crucial external factor. The recent legislation, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, is expected to generate higher income tax refunds for lower income consumers this spring.
And since Burlington's core shoppers are highly value conscious, that influx of capital often goes directly into retail spending,
providing a significant and predictable sales catalyst for their momentum.
That convergence of internal optimization and external economic factors makes a powerful investment thesis. Now let's talk about a trend that is fundamentally changing the grocery store aisle, the move by major retailers to make their store brands not just cheap, but premium.
This is a fundamental change in consumer perception. Private label brands used to be seen as the lowest common denominator, a generic knockoff. That is no longer true.
Since 2022, private label growth has surpassed national brands, reaching a record 21% market share of grocery purchases in 2025.
And the shift is most pronounced in refrigerated foods, suggesting consumers are embracing quality private label options even in fresh categories.
So the stigma of the generic brand is evaporating.
Completely. A 2025 study cited in the sources found that 84% of consumers now trust the quality of store brands the same or more than national brands.
And nearly three quarters of consumers can't even distinguish between private label and national brand images when shown side by side.
Consumers are prioritizing quality, price, and increasingly uniqueness over brand name loyalty.
And retailers are actively cultivating this premium image.
They are heavily invested. Costco set the blueprint with Kirkland Signature, turning it into a premium line that often matches or exceeds national brand quality.
Trader Joe's built its entire identity around unique, curated private label products.
And Walmart has launched a new premium line called Better Goods, which uses culinary trend data to feature elevated options like lemon tarts and okra chips.
Even Kroger's Simple Truth line has outpaced national brands for 9 consecutive quarters.
And the growth potential for this shift is massive, especially when looking at the international context. In the U.S., private label penetration is still only around 20%.
But in Canada, it's 25 to 30%, and in Europe, it's often over 40%.
Which suggests U.S. retailers have a huge runway to continue expanding their high-quality private label businesses.
Moving from retail dynamics to financial regulation, the sources detail a massive structural problem rooted in centuries of American history, the fear of mixing banking and commerce.
This is a debate that dates back to the very founding of the country. The memory of Aaron Burr using the Manhattan Company as a shell to engage in both banking and commercial ventures.
Which led to a fundamental, deeply rooted cultural fear of allowing institutions backed by insured deposits to also engage in high-risk commercial business.
And this has resulted in banks being kept inside a highly restrictive, regulated box.
But today, that fear is creating a modern problem known as regulatory arbitrage. We hear this term often. What exactly does it mean in this context?
Regulatory arbitrage means exploiting the difference between regulatory structures. Banks operate under the highest capital, liquidity, and oversight requirements.
But non-banks, tech firms, payment companies, crypto issuers are now performing quasi-banking services with far fewer regulations.
And this gives unregulated firms a significant competitive edge over chartered banks. The problem isn't the competition itself. The problem is the wildly uneven playing field.
And the scale of assets being handled by these non-banks is staggering.
The numbers are alarming. Non-bank financial intermediaries now hold about 65% of total financial assets, dwarfing the 23% held by traditional banks.
The sources estimate that payment stablecoins alone could eventually siphon $6.6 trillion.
A full third of U.S. deposits away from regulated banks. If a third of the deposit base leaves, it fundamentally undermines the bank's ability to lend and support the real economy.
So the argument presented is counterintuitive.
Yeah.
That the Federal Reserve and other regulators should actually loosen the chains on banks to allow them to compete and innovate.
Which, in the long run, could actually make them safer. That is the core argument for regulatory modernization. The source argues that non-traditional activities often make banks safer because they provide diversified fee revenue.
Reducing their reliance on risky pure lending for profitability.
Exactly. Congress recognized this need back in 1999, granting the Fed authority to allow banks expanded powers to compete. But in almost 30 years, the Fed has authorized only 5 non-traditional activities.
That pace of regulatory approval is glacial compared to the speed of technological innovation we discussed earlier.
Precisely. Regulators, particularly the Fed, need to use their existing authority to promote bank competitiveness and innovation. This isn't about protecting banks. It's about ensuring a fair market for consumers and small businesses.
A compelling case for breaking down those historical firewalls. Let's wrap up with a look at personal finance, focusing on retirement and the critical role of health savings accounts.
Especially given the rising cost of healthcare, the urgency around healthcare cost management is exceptionally high right now. The sources note that health insurance premiums are set to more than double next year for over 20 million Americans enrolled in ACA coverage.
Because Congress failed to secure a deal on critical premium subsidies that are expiring.
And this looming cost crisis is driving millions of consumers toward high deductible health plans, which are necessary to qualify for a health savings account, or HSA.
And HSAs offer that exceptional triple tax advantage that financial advisors constantly recommend. Let's briefly break that down.
The triple tax advantage is what makes HSAs a superior retirement vehicle. First, contributions go in pre-tax, reducing your current year's taxable income.
Second, the funds grow tax-free, like a Roth account.
And third, and most importantly, withdrawals are tax-free, provided they are used for qualified medical expenses now or anytime in retirement.
Tax-free in, tax-free growth, tax-free out. What are the contribution limits for the new year?
For 2026, the limits are set at $4,400 for individuals and $8,750 for families, plus a $1,000 catch-up contribution for those age 55 and older.
We're also seeing expanded eligibility, making this powerful tool available to more people.
That's right. The same legislation we mentioned earlier, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, expanded HSA eligibility to include certain bronze and catastrophic ACA plans. This means an estimated 10 million Americans are newly eligible.
That sounds like a tremendous opportunity. But the sources also point to a harsh reality about financial feasibility for many of those newly eligible households.
That's the challenge. The benefit is profound, but the cost of entry is a high deductible. About a third of Americans, according to one survey, simply lack the budget to fully fund or even benefit from the tax-free growth.
Because they couldn't cover an unexpected $500 medical bill.
So for many, they're forced to immediately withdraw the contributions they make to cover their high deductibles, often within the same year.
So they still benefit from the pre-tax contribution, which is essentially an immediate tax break, but they miss out on the long-term compounding tax-free growth component.
Precisely. The system works best as a retirement savings vehicle for the financially stable, but for lower to middle income families, it often functions simply as a smart pre-tax savings account for immediate healthcare expenses.
Let's conclude our comprehensive deep dive with a review of the current economic snapshot and a few notable corporate actions from the week.
Looking at the November data, the economy is clearly slowing. Unemployment edged up to 4.6%. Inflation surprised slightly higher at 2.7%.
Q3 GDP growth is expected to finalize around 3.2%.
Critically, wage growth is slowing, which is squeezing household budgets, especially when paired with looming high housing and health costs. This explains the retail caution we discussed.
What were the most notable corporate actions from the week leading into the holidays?
We saw a significant pressure on the EV transition. Ford Motor took a massive $19.5 billion write-down and abruptly killed several electric vehicle models,
signaling that the rapid adoption everyone expected isn't materializing smoothly.
In consumer robotics, iRobot, the maker of the Roomba vacuum, filed for bankruptcy. In finance, PayPal took a huge step by officially applying to become a chartered bank. And finally, activist investor Elliott Management built a $1 billion stake in Lululemon Athletica.
And finally, a great detail on consumer engagement. Netflix's intriguing move into physical retail with the concept of the Netflix house.
This is a fascinating strategic shift in IP monetization. Netflix is realizing they need engagement that goes beyond the screen. They're opening experiential venues, like the one planned for the King of Prussia Mall.
Admission is free, but the experiences, food, and merchandise are paid.
They feature interactive exhibits based on hit shows like Wednesday and One Piece, virtual reality games set inside Squid Games, and themed restaurants, Netflix Bites. It's a direct response to build deep brand loyalty.
And one final quick note on commodities.
Gold is continuing its impressive run, surging again and hitting $4,386 an ounce. It's reinforcing its position as a key safe haven asset in a globally uncertain environment.
This deep dive has covered massive structural changes, from the stability of internal corporate succession and the reengineering of the American diet, to the complex failure of regulation in the face of technology.
The themes are deeply interconnected. Technology, specifically AI, is the common thread, On one hand, it's driving unprecedented wealth creation and efficiency, exemplified by that $5.5 trillion generated by the leaders of Apple, Walmart, and Berkshire.
But on the other hand?
That same technology is creating profound geopolitical and national security vulnerabilities, as we saw with Tencent circumventing chip restrictions and challenging the foundation of fair market practices through personalized pricing.
It brings us back to that question about the blurring lines, not just between investing and gambling, but between market knowledge, algorithmic control, and personal economic stability.
Exactly. We have algorithms determining what price you pay for eggs based on proprietary data about your behavior, while prediction markets are trying to commodify geopolitical outcomes into wagers.
At the same time, the regulatory firewall separating commercial, personal, and regulated finance are eroding.
They're crumbling as non-banks gain massive scale and technology giants push the boundaries. So, here is a final provocative thought for you to consider as you digest this information.
Go on.
If AI is driving personalized pricing based on every data point companies know about you, and prediction markets are blurring the line between investing and gambling, how long until the algorithmic insight that fuels Wall Street's success, the ability to predict outcomes with high accuracy, is deployed to not just predict, but perhaps even dictate your personal consumption and your financial stability?
We are seeing the separation between commercial, personal, and regulated finance crumble in real time.
And the resulting landscape will require intense financial vigilance to navigate.
That is a powerful and necessary thought to leave us with, highlighting the vigilance required as we head into 2026. Thank you for guiding us through this immense and complex material.
My pleasure. It was a dense but necessary dive.
And thank you, the listener, for joining us for the Deemed Dive. We hope this exploration of Barron's Magazine for the week of December 22, 2025 has given you the critical context and forethought you need to be ahead of the curve in the new year. We'll see you next time.